Hello.
Hello. So
Good morning,
yes.
sir. How are you?
Good. I'm
Oh,
very
my hair's
good.
not all too crazy here. Let's see what happens when I turn this light on. I don't want to.
Good.
Oh, my God.
Well, I'll just close this down. But
Have my ink, my British. Let's see, what's that one? That's the underground. Over here, we got the other one here. This is the. Let me see here.
good morning, David. Are you in the United States?
No, I'm in the UK. No, we I don't leave till Tuesday. No, so I'm still
Ah,
at home.
okay.
Yep.
Good,
So.
good, good. So, Brian, are you going to be recording this?
Yes, it's recording right now.
It's recording right now.
Barring technology problems, I think we should be good. I always hate
Great.
it.
And you'll get the sound to me so I can produce it, right?
Yes. David, I'm
Marvelous.
Brian Chandler. And nice
Hello.
to meet you, sir. This is
And
Nina.
I'm Ann Arbor
Ann
for
Arbor.
your
Yes,
purposes.
ma'am.
I've been Ann Arbor for many years, and I've been booking it. I was up all night watching the documentary and listening to all the interviews, and yeah. So,
You're excited. You're ready. Good.
I'm very ready. So I want to ask about you, because you're the one that Americans don't know about. So I was told, "Oh, you get to interview David Singleton." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure who that is." And so I read about you, but I want you to tell me who you are. Tell me a
Well,
little bit.
let me tell you a very funny story where you started with it, which is, you don't know who David Singleton is, because, oh, about 10 years ago, I've written a series of books called The Vicar Chronicles, amongst other things. They're sort of whodunits based in the music industry. And about 10 years ago, I was booked to do a book tour in California to go around and promote this book. The people who were promoting this book tour got in touch with me before I left and said, "There's a problem." And I said, "Well, what's the problem?" And they said, "The problem is you don't exist." And I said, "What do you mean I don't exist?" And they said, "Well, we've just looked on Wikipedia and you don't exist." So, which was then cured. But
Yes.
in a strange way, I took that as a backhanded compliment, because although probably my core, the things I most care about, actually probably my own creative work, my own songwriting and book writing, most of my life I've been working as a producer. And I don't think the role of the producer is to be known. The role of the producer is to invisibly, ideally, make a pipe. Here are these musicians, and I want to be an invisible conduit that nobody knew about, that helped take this music over here and produce this perfect record over here. Nobody wants to know that a producer messed around with it. Or, it's a bit like saying you have a perfect baby born and you ask, "Well, who was the midwife?" Nobody wants to know who the midwife was.
Ah,
So, to some extent, I took it as a backhanded compliment that apparently I didn't exist on Wikipedia, although I do now. And I've been doing more things overtly. So, before the King Crimson, I managed the recent King Crimson as well as the other things I did. And before those shows, I started doing speaking to fans for an hour before. Keen fans who came in, they paid extra to come in early, and I would meet and greet them and talk to them before the shows. And Robert also joined me on those talks. And
the royal packages, right?
royal package, that is exactly it.
I paid
And
attention.
there you go. And to some extent, the talks that Robert and I are now doing grew out of that. We both enjoyed doing them. We enjoyed the fact that you get asked some wonderfully off-the-wall questions, and you end up, being led in places, exciting thoughts, places you wouldn't have gone. Before the shows, Robert wasn't able really to engage with the fans, because obviously he had to keep his head space clear, because he was about to play a King Crimson show. So we thought, "Well, hold on, why don't we do the talking without the show?" Hence, we did one 2 years ago on the East Coast, which went very well. We really enjoyed it. I think the people who came really enjoyed it.
So David, let me
So
ask you
that,
this. In these, and sorry to interrupt here, I The price I'm thinking is about $100 to $100 US right. to see. What kind of a audience are you looking at? Whereas these are tried and true, right? These are people that have. I mean, I've met Robert back when he did the Frippertronics yes. tour, and this is how far I go back in radio. So yep. I would say I'm definitely a tried and true sort of listener. What about the new yep. group that says, "What $100? My goodness."
Well, sadly, the one thing you don't get to control really when you do a talk is the ticket prices. As in, you know, you announce you'd like to go somewhere, and promoters come out and say, "Well, we'll bring you here, there, wherever."
Right.
But mostly the answer would be that it is the tried and true. It isn't necessary. There were some very young people, interesting enough, at the talks
that's great.
That we did.
That's what my question was. It wasn't just
so they don't have to be. So they don't have to be older tried and true. But in the end, they are people who really want to be there. Part of what I find exciting about these talks, actually, I sort of like to have an agenda, as in something that if nobody else is asking anything interesting, this is what I'd like to talk about anyway. And the thing that interests me most is, what is this thing music? You know, as in, if you talk about the tried and true, you know, I've spent my whole life in the service of music, pretty much, as has Robert as a musician. And most of the people in the audience who come using your tried and true will also, not necessarily as performers, but music will have been a central thing in their life. That's why you want to come and hear Robert and me talking about music. It's because music is somewhere this has touched you incredibly deeply. And pretty much everyone in those audiences, I think, has somehow met that. And you know, so when we have what might seem quite esoteric discussions about, well, what is music? Why are we doing this? What is this thing that changes our lives that we're all in service of? So yes, they're not necessarily older fans, but everybody who come will want to be there because this means something to them. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good answer. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. I mean, I feel like we're having our own private royal package here this
morning.
They
won't need to come. They can just listen to this instead.
Well, I have an extra room in my bedroom in North Beach when you're here. Ha ha. Go ahead, okay. Anna.
Yeah. Anyway, so in the documentary, it's very clear to me from watching Fripp that he's a spiritual person, and that his goal when he's on stage is to move people very deeply, is to create an experience that touches a very core part of each of the listeners. And I respect that as a musician myself. I mean, that's really what it is I'm an energy healer in my other life, and music is energy healing too. The music that he's making is intended to in some way really change someone's life, someone's experience, touch them at their core, move what needs to be moved. And I have a lot of respect for that. I have to say that watching him, I mean, I see that it's tortured him. And I want to ask, the questions I want to ask came out of watching the documentary because I was fascinated by it. go ahead.
Well, no, I was just trying to say, yes, I think you're absolutely right that when we're putting together a King Crimson concert, we're not trying to put on an entertainment event. If you take that isn't to disparage entertainment events, by the way. I've been to lots of shows where, you know, you're intended to jump up and down, take photographs, see fantastic video. They can be wonderful things to go to, so I'm not disparaging them. But yes, a King Crimson concert is trying to be some form of a spiritual, if you want to use that word, union between the musicians, the music, and the audience. This thing, when those three things come together, and something magical happens. So, and when we're doing them, when we're planning them, and in the venues we try to play, even the way the band presented themselves, which you've probably seen on the video, we took away all the lighting. There's now no lighting effects. This is just almost like an orchestral concert. Here they are, the band standing on stage. It's you, the music. We're not putting any distractions in the way. And obviously those people practice incredibly hard to try and play, you know, these pieces such that you can have that moment happen. And oddly enough, to some extent, we're hoping that at the best moments, we're hoping to achieve something similar, but not with music in the talks, because they are totally improvised. When we go into this, we don't come with an agenda, as in, we're not going to say, hey, I'm promoting my book, so I'm going to read you bits of my book, or there are pre-prepared stories we're going to tell you. We are hoping that people will come all the better with very real questions, as in real questions that are for them, so that we can enter into a real discussion, and we will all come away from it richer. You know, I don't mean financially.
No, I get it.
So that's what we aspire to do with this. And I know that you're maybe familiar, but for years, Robert has been trying to remove photography from concerts.
Correct.
He's been very consistent with this. I mean, ever since, back in the 80s, long before everybody else got on this, Robert's always been saying, hold on, photography, we shouldn't be having photography. And fortunately, a lot of larger artists or better known artists have now also come out with the same thing. So that I think when for a long time people thought, who is this Fripp character and why does he keep saying, I can't take photographs? And actually, I think people are beginning to realize that there is a very, very valid point of view. And
well, you wouldn't take photographs in church.
I was going to say that because I mentioned this to Robert when we're discussing, and I say, well, you know, I wasn't asking Robert what harm does it do, because I know what harm it does, but he rephrased it to me, and his exact analogy was, he said, if you were in church and you were about to take the Holy Communion up at the altar and somebody took out their camera and took a photograph, that moment would be ruined. And to him, the camera in the concert does exactly the same thing.
Whereas Tony Levin, the master photographer, I've talked to Tony about four or five times over the years and met him. He's a great guy, but unbelievable with the Stickmen. He's taking the pictures for us. So he's taking the postcard pictures for us. Why do we have to take the picture of just a little tiny person? Yeah, let him do it.
And it's absurd because firstly, obviously, if you're watching your camera taking a picture, you aren't present. So this whole thing, the audience half of the equation has been removed from this magical moment. And secondly, you're not even experiencing it, are you? Because you go to a show and you choose to watch it on a thing that's 2x4. The whole thing is mad. And we do obviously accept that people do like their own memento, which is why at the end of the shows, we said, okay, at the end of the show, after we finish, take as many pictures as we like. We're not being shy about being photographed. You just don't take the photographs when we're playing the music.
Yeah, I don't think people I've found most people don't really care. They're pretty cool. It's almost like they have to sneak it, like they're smoking pot for their first time without anybody seeing them. Like, oh, I got it. so it's maybe a little more fun.
Yeah, no, and you do get a few people annoyingly who always do, but I was amazed, in fact, how much the audience respected it, because that was why when Robert gave up live performance in 2008, he said, I don't believe in the modern commercial culture of concerts that you can achieve what I wish to achieve in a concert. He said, you know, that in the modern world with where the audiences are behaving, I don't believe that sort of concert is possible again. And in 2014, when he put the band back together, we said, well, fine, you know, that hurdle remained to be leapt. And he walked off stage once in Toronto in 2015. Somebody took a picture. We had all the signs up and somebody took a picture and he walked off and didn't come back. and actually, although the rest of the band would have been twitching, that one action meant that actually from then on, pretty much the audience is self-policed remarkably well. And actually it never became such an issue. There were always a few, but it was never much of an issue after that. I think it was Bob Dylan who stopped during a song and said, well, you know, I can either pose and be a model or I'll sing you music, but we're not doing both at the same time. So it's not, you know, it's become much more mainstream, this notion that, you know, perhaps the audience should be listening to the music.
Absolutely. And you have some other questions, I think, were pretty vital here. Why don't we take some of your time here? What kind of tea are you drinking? Yorkshire, or is that?
Oddly enough, this is mint tea. It should be Earl Grey, really, as we're going to be Englishmen abroad. So if we drink tea, real tea, Robert and I tend to drink Earl Grey tea. This actually is a mint tea.
Okay.
So
it's a I'm doing the Yorkshire. I'm a Yorkshire fan today.
Well, yeah. Oh, very good. That is a key question. There's a key question. Good.
A key question. Well, let's talk. I want to go back to if we were creating an equation or some kind of a model of what it takes to perform music and truly move people. What does it take? What would you say? What would Fripp say?
I suppose I'm used to doing these talks with Robert, so I tend to, you know, veer away from the what would Robert say. But the answer is that the performance has to be true. It's actually in a way remarkably simple. So in obviously in King Crimson music, which is very complicated, you know, in Robert's world particularly, as he's now trying at 70 to be perform pieces that he wrote in his 20s in some cases, you know, he has to practice and practice and practice and practice to be the guitarist that can perform these pieces. But that isn't actually necessary for a true musical experience at a concert. I did an interview a while ago with somebody who was writing a book, and I loved it because we got into the same conversation, and he said his book was basically about the spirituality of punk music. And I loved that because that seems to be a clash of concepts, because if we think spiritual music, people tend to think, reverential music. But, you know, I was a huge fan of the Boomtown Rats, but you know, so the Sex Pistols, whether or not you think they were the best musicians in the world, I am sure their concerts would have been like that. So it simply has to be true. So I think if the musicians are truly open to the music, and the audience are, it can happen. So with different bands, so I suppose it's complicated after that. You'd need different bands, but you don't have to be King Crimson and, you know, practice however many hours a day it is to achieve that. In King Crimson music, you do, but there will be people, there'll be a man strumming a guitar who just picked up a guitar, strumming a guitar, who can, if he is open, dial in the world of music. And that's what's so wonderful about music. And there will be music alive and speaking to us all. So,
well, it's interesting. I see Fripp very much like the classical conservatory trained musician, which is what I am. You know, you practice hours and hours and hours a day, except that King Crimson, people are improvising. They're not playing off a score. They're not being conducted. They're improvising. So they're like jazz musicians, and they bring in elements of many different genres of music. And it turns into something that is transportative. And so I would say he has to practice because it's about getting into the state. It's all about the state that he's in, which is why he gets frustrated. I get that.
No, it's being present for the music. I think in the movie, Robert says, you know, the music never goes away, we do.
Yes.
The music is there, we're just not present for it. So you have to be present and open to music. Your other comment is interesting, because it's funny how, particularly on these, some of the more interesting conversations that occurred on these talks, Rob and I, are actually, in a sense, between the two of us. When somebody asks a question, and then we end up saying something to each other that we probably wouldn't have said or hadn't
thought of. That's right. It's performance art. It's purely performance art.
And the notion of Robert effectively being a conservatoire musician came up. And I pointed out to him that is, I think, why Robert is one of those unique figures, why he is a standout figure in the music industry, is in a sense that he is a misfit. He is a misfit because, in a sense, he is a classical musician with all the sensibility that go with a classical musician, wanting really to play concerts that we played in a totally classical, but he's playing in a rock environment. And I said to him, so all the things that make him uncomfortable, a lot of which are actually to do with rock concerts and the way people behave at rock concerts. I said, actually, the discomfort, I said, put up with the discomfort because that's what makes you interesting.
Well, I like the banner sometimes where you'll say something and what was it you said? Music is, because you've come from, did you come from Cambridge or Oxford?
Yes, I came from Cambridge. Yes.
Cambridge, okay. I've been to Oxford, but I mean, I traveled. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Saw the Einstein on the wall with the chalk drawing that nobody's erased yet. but you said to him, music is, and you, if you don't mind saying what you remember in the speech, what was it you said?
Music? I don't know which one.
Okay, well, I think I say so many different things. I know. We pontificate as we grow.
But oddly enough, it won't be the one you're thinking of now because I haven't said this one yet. But when I was saying to Robert about this whole notion of what is this thing music that we're chasing and what does it do, I said, Robert, okay, the best shot I have currently, which I will undoubtedly be saying at some of these talks, I imagine, is that music is the language of the soul. I said to him, that is as close as I can get right now to why does music touch us? But remind me of the one you want and I'll follow on from that.
Okay, I'll try to remember. But what I wanted to say out of that was that you said it slowly as if you were the teacher, the professor, and he looks over and he goes, would you mind saying that again? And you said, okay. And then you said it, and then you looked over at him, and this is just a video. And then he goes,
oh, yes.
Well, go on with it. And he gets very angry, and you just go, okay, I, of course, here.
Oh, no, you're quite right, because actually, I do remember it was literally at one of those talks when I've been thinking about, I don't revisit them. That's why these things are, they are unique improvisation. But no, I do remember the one when we were discussing what is music. And I did come up.
But it had to do with the listener. That just refresh. You did say
it did. No, it did. No, it did because I was going into, I'd realized that what is the difference between music and muzak? What's the difference? So you get muzak, which is this annoying noise that you get in a lift. And that's muzak. But actually the same tune played somewhere else can transport you and be music. Which is why you're quite right. When I thought about it, I thought, well, the difference is the listener. So you're absolutely right. So in fact, one of the things that is necessary for music is the listener. The listener is changing
the music. And I think that's a very interesting thing because we've always thought of the listener as being a passive, especially even in classical. Don't say anything. Don't sneeze. Don't even pick your nose. Don't even shh, shh. The listener is very important. And I think that's that's good. I like that.
No, that was oddly enough for my I'm planning to do some homework, I think, before we go out again, which is to go and review some of the clips that have been put up, because I'm sure people will be doing that and say, hold on, in New York you said this, what do you think now? So I will.
Well, actually, what I did mean
yes. But I do remember that, and it continues to fascinate me. You know, the world of music and why music is so powerful to all of us.
And I think Robert also said too. He said, Indian music, they get it with all of the nuances. You know, the beats, the 16 beats. I think he's right. I know he's right about that. And I think that was a discussion you had one time too.
Yes. Yep. Yes. So, I think one of my favorite comments, it was after the New York talk that we did, was someone came to me afterwards and said, it's fascinating because I've listened really for 2 hours, 2.5 hours to two people talking about music.
I listened. Not to listening. It was a long time. I know more about his house than his house contractor right now.
So loosely, they said, no, we've listened to two people talking about music for 2.5 hours, but I went out of that talk hearing music in my head.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Somehow, it had the same effect as a music concert. Although all we were doing was talking, they said, you know, it came out, it was as if I'd attended a concert. Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about memorable. So you've done a bunch of these improvised talks, the Englishman Abroad. Concept. And tell me a little bit about some of your most memorable ones.
Gosh, I've oddly enough, in a way, the ones that are most memorable to people are the ones that I don't remember. Now, that may seem odd, but they're passing comments that you make. So when somebody asks a question completely off the wall, we were asked about marriage at one. Silence. Somebody asked about the role of silence. And they're ones where there is no pre-prepared thought. Robert, I realized later, it was only when I watched the videos that I realized Robert always, when there was a question that was particularly off the wall, Robert started having a habit of saying, good question. What do you think, David?
Yes, I see. I've seen that. Because he trusts and relies on you as a sense and sensibility of looking through the mirror while he's, he is the mirror.
Precisely, yeah. So, but actually, on several of those afterwards, people have written to me afterwards and said, oh, I loved what you said. And oddly enough, I didn't recall what I'd said. It was just so fresh, and there you are with 300 people staring at you while you think, well, okay, what's the role of silence? That I had to go back and ask them, okay, what did I say that so touched you?
What did the brain say inside of me that I didn't remember?
Yes, what did my brain say while I was mildly terrified, thinking, do I really know anything about this question? So those are the moments that, I suppose, they're pure moments. Maybe that's why I don't remember them in a funny way, as opposed to when I'm when you're on familiar ground. You know, somebody asks you about, I don't know, the traumas of the music industry. I can discuss that all day because, you know, that they may be looking at it a fresh way, but I know what I'm going to say, or I'm on safe ground with that. If I'm talking about managing King Crimson or things King Crimson or Archives of King Crimson, so the fun ones are the ones when you're really completely floating free. I've been very unhelpful in quoting exactly what I said to you, but those are the moments that you sort of live for. I think they're great. A bit like a wonderful improvisation at a concert, I suppose, isn't it? It's the same.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is, Anne. What do you think?
Yeah, it's performance art of its own kind.
Yeah.
And so, as a musician, what I see is, you can prepare up to a certain point, and then. Yeah. You're present, you're there, they're asking you questions, you're in the moment, and as you said, you're floating free. And that's the fun of it. I mean, for those who love to be on stage, and clearly you do, to me, I can't imagine. One time I had to speak in front of a large group of people, and I was sitting on a panel, and then I had to get up and speak, and I got back to my seat afterwards, and the guy sitting next to me, he said, "You really loved that, didn't you?" I said, "You know, I've never taken crack cocaine, but I imagine that the high I'm experiencing having spoken to this group of people is probably comparable or better." And it's about being in the moment, being in the flow, and connecting with other people. And so talk a little bit about Englishmen Abroad. Why did you choose to come to California instead of the East Coast this time?
Well, it was partly to do with, so last time we did it and we got a tour bus. I don't want to tell you the horrors of what happened last time, but so the final King Crimson tour, partly because it was a COVID tour, we used a tour bus, which people hadn't been using for ages. And suddenly I persuaded these 70-year-old gentlemen, what we're going to do now is we're not going to stay in smart hotels anymore. Every night we're going to get on a bus because we were trying to keep ourselves in a little bubble because of the COVID issues. So we're just going to travel around in the bus. But the bus actually worked relatively well. And so when Robert and I were looking at doing a speaking tour, we thought, well, actually, if we did it on a bus, we could go between different places. We could sleep on the bus and it would work. Except the bus we got was absolutely horrible. So it turned out to be a traumatic experience rather than a pleasant experience. And so increasingly now, we're trying to find a way of doing these things when it remains fun for us, it's possible, it's easy. And so we wanted somewhere where we could stay, but we could actually drive on the day of the next show each time. So therefore you're really looking at places that are about two and a half hours apart. So you can stay in a hotel, drive to the next venue, do the show, drive to the next venue. And so having done some of the East Coast, it seemed the obvious place where you could do this was California. You know, you would be able to drive. We're effectively going down, I think, going from San Francisco, detours, but San Francisco down to LA effectively. Right. And right. you can drive down with a nice 2-2.5 hour drive so that there's nothing too strenuous. Because if you, you need to be fresh when you get there. So the problem is if the drives are much longer than that, you're going to be addled in the evening when you're trying to do the show. So, but something like that. So the West Coast presented itself, as particularly California presented itself as being a very, very simple place. We both promised our wives we will only be away from home for 2 weeks.
Yes, dear.
So we can fly out, we can do 10 dates and fly back again within a 2 week period, driving down through California. So in a way, it was a practical consideration that really lent itself to it.
It makes complete common sense, right? And you and I were both addressing that. There's this funny story where Ken Nordine is talking to a friend of his and he says, well, now we can do a 3 month tour. Let me talk to your wife. And he calls her and he says, I'd like to take Tom for a little 3 month journey. Do you mind? She says, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So the wife does actually have something to say here.
Yes, I know. So, and we were offered, I know Las Vegas was keen to have us. There were some other places and the agent kept on saying, can't we please add a gig here? And I said, well, without getting on a plane and losing a couple of days flying in and out, or and there's nowhere really to stop in the middle, how does that fit? So it'll be fun, because assuming this one goes as well as the last one, we probably quite like to do at least one a year of these. It'll be interesting to see where else we can find where you can produce a little journey, you know, without too much stress between them. So, but that's the quick answer to why. And Robert's sister lives in San Francisco, so that's a lovely place to start. So yeah, all good.
He used to live in San Francisco.
Oh, what I know Robert's live. And Robert's sister lives in San.
Oh,
Francisco.
Sister. Oh, yeah.
Sister. Yeah. Robert used to live in New York. In the late 70s. Robert
that was the 70s, back to William Burroughs era. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so what else can I tell you?
I want to know about the Vicar Chronicles.
Yeah.
Talk about work.
No, so the Vicar Chronicles, right. So the genesis of the Vicar Chronicles, I mentioned before, I'm on both Robert and I on probably very happy ground if you want us to describe the missteps of the music industry or the problems of, you know, making a living in the music industry. And a long time ago now, probably 20 years ago, I was working late in the night with Robert, and my inbox, as usual, was popping in with various traumas and legal cases and other things that were flying through my, not all involving us, but just ones I was being told about. And I just said to Robert, why has nobody written a series of whodunits based in the music industry? Because you don't have to make the stories up. The stories present themselves on a daily basis, and it's an interesting background. And it's and this Dorset voice sitting behind me in the studio said, "Because you haven't written them yet, David." So I took that as a challenge, and I started a blog by a fictional record producer called The Vicar. That then grew into the third one is now out. So I've now written three books, The Vicar Chronicles, sort of whodunits in the music industry.
Are they short pieces or complete?
No, the first two combine into one paperback, but no, they're full sort of 300-400 page books. So no, they're, we are selling them actually. So if you come to if you're there at the shows, they will be there. All three of them will, The Vicar Chronicles will be available. So that was the genesis of The Vicar Chronicles. And the fun spin-off, which I hadn't foreseen, was that having created this fictional record producer and doing the books, it would be fun to make an album by this fictional record producer.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm a very frustrated songwriter in that I find trying to find an outlet for songs that I'd written. And I thought, this is wonderful, because I have all the songs, and now I've got this fictional person. And I started writing to people with no explanation, saying, you know, would you like to work with the Vicar? No explanation of who he was or why he was. And all these wonderful people kept on writing and say, yes, I'll come and sing for the Vicar, or I'll work for the Vicar. I even at one time started writing to people even differently to that, sort of as an endorsement almost, just with similarly without explanation, saying, would you like to tell me what it was like to work with the Vicar? to people who hadn't, you know, a Nick Cave. I mean, so I got some wonderful answers back from people just who obviously understood it and entered into the spirit of this thing. So I created this entire life around this completely fictional record producer.
Perhaps
he's not fictional because he's produced a record. So how can he be fictional? Anyway, yes. So the Vicar Chronicles, great fun. Yeah.
I love it. So let's talk a little bit about legacy, because it's clear that that kept coming up for me as a theme in the documentary. You get to be a certain age, and I think we're all at that age, where you start to think about what's going to happen after this life, and how do you want to be remembered, and what is it that you're leaving behind that other people can enjoy and think about you? And clearly, Fripp says he doesn't want to play and do concerts anymore. So he's written a book. Other people have remixed his music. There's all this spin-off stuff. And he's doing these talks, these improvised talks. And he's still doing guitar craft, you said.
Yes. Yep.
So he is leaving a legacy, or he's creating a legacy for himself. And you've done The Vicar and so on.
Yep.
What do you see happening as you go forward in terms of legacy for both of you?
I don't think you can concern yourself directly with your legacy, as in the world will determine your legacy, not you. But I think there is a responsibility to manage things as well as you can. And that's part of just literally caring for the music. So even if you take, the very first album, In the Court of the Crimson King, I think as custodians of that music, which is really what we are, it's part of our role to do that to the very best of our ability. So that would be partly ensuring that the album, you know, is now available and mixed in whatever the current forms are. So Atmos, for example, which is becoming increasingly popular with people, for the album, you know, to be available now to young fans. Okay, if you want to listen to Atmos, you can listen to it in Atmos. It's the reason why we put things on Spotify, despite the fact there's no living to be made really for us out of Spotify. But part of our responsibility is that music can carry on living and being heard and changing people's lives. So therefore it's on Spotify for the next generation. So I think that your responsibility is to curate your work as well as you can. And part oddly, if I know Robert's main agenda with the last incarnation of King Crimson was one of completion. He didn't feel that King Crimson had completed satisfactorily with the 2008. There was a 2008 tour, which was back with Adrian, with some of first time Gavin played. But he didn't feel that was a satisfactory completion.
Says he didn't have the band he wanted until 2013.
He wanted a band that could go out honorably. It revisited the earlier catalog, but in a new way, which was a fascinating dichotomy. So both it appeared to be playing old music, but in fact was playing new music in a way, because they'd reinvented it for this completely different lineup. So it was a way of making it a true new musical experience, but also satisfying fans who wanted to hear the old material. So part of that was, I don't know if you'd say it was about legacy, but it was about completion. It was about meaning. So we have completed well, and the final performances of King Crimson are honorable and are worthy of the band. So that would be my thought is, yes, that we have to curate, we have a duty to the music and to the art to curate it as well as we can. That isn't quite the same as legacy, because I think you don't get to write your own obituaries and your own legacy. That's the world. The world will do that for you.
Clearly they have. So which was the first King Crimson record that you produced?
Oh gosh. Well, actually, probably the first one when I really was a producer was.
Was that with Peter Gabriel? Was that with Peter Gabriel?
No, no. The first thing, I mean, I've worked on lots, but I wouldn't have been described as the producer, although I was beginning to play that role. So, because the first album that was recorded after I started working with Robert, we started together in 1989, was Thrack. And with Thrack, I didn't produce in the sense of have an overall view of any of the individual pieces, but together with Robert, I sewed the album together. So the segues and putting the idea of putting Robert's soundscape on top of Bill's drumming for the boom and the flow of the pieces, that was what I did. And I didn't do it for the construction of Light. I revisited that afterwards. I was away. We had a company called Bootleg TV during the construction of Light. But The Power to Believe probably is the one that has my strongest, of the studio albums, is the one that has my strongest imprint on it. Because similarly, I wasn't there at the sessions, but when Robert came back, he wasn't even sure they had an album. He thought the sessions hadn't quite coalesced, and he said, I'm not sure if we quite got the material. And so similarly, I took the theme of The Power to Believe and flew that same line, actually. It's a beautiful line from Adrian's. I flew it in various places on the album. So in fact, we ended up with a Power to Believe 1, 2, 3, and even 4, I think. And again, gave the album a narrative arc, which in the end, I think was stronger than the pieces. Well, I don't think it was stronger than the pieces. I think the pieces were wonderful, but that's probably, of the studio albums, that's my role. Sadly, I've also developed, I think it's necromancy, Robert describes it, rescuing dodgy sound recordings. I've spent far too much of my life doing that. Not a skill that anyone would want to develop. Why develop that skill? But probably I've rescued more dodgy sound recordings than anyone else in the world. And
all producers do that. I know. I mean, even radio guys, do that too.
You're forever giving the unlistenable and say, can you please make this listenable, David? And you discover that you can. And there's a wonderful cross. It comes back to this magical thing, music again. You start off with a really poor recording where what you're hearing is the quality of the recording, as in, you know, this is unlistenable because of the hiss, the hum, the bangs, the crack, whatever it is. This is unlistenable. And you work on it. And then there is that magical crossover point where suddenly you're now hearing the music. The sound is never going to be pristine, but now, despite everything, now you can hear the music. And at that point, actually, you can almost stop because I've now moved it from the unlistenable to a point where, no, the music is alive again and we can now hear the music. So, yeah. So yes, I've done that to literally hundreds of recordings, and yes, not a skill any of us want, but it's probably one we all develop.
And it's interesting because here we go. Here comes AI right around the corner saying, hello.
Yes.
Hello, yes. Larry Cemetery. My name's,
Yeah, it'll be interesting how many of these things, improve with automation. Some of those techniques may do. I've yet to do anything AI, so it'll be interesting where how it touches. I know people are probably rightly very worried about AI when it's generated from art, as in, take three pictures and I'll generate you a new one in the style of this guy by mimicking his other three, and whether that's copyright infringements, whether it's really art. So I think when AI is effectively generating art, I think we all have queries about how that might be. But actually, AI might well clean up old recordings very well. I don't know, but it may well do. If AI can come to understand that magical thing I just discussed, which is when music is music, and knows which bits, therefore knows which bits to remove and which bits to leave in order to achieve that thing, then maybe we'll all get a life and we'll actually be doing creative things instead of cleaning up poor recordings.
I'm sorry, really? Dave, I can't do that.
Yes.
You just know.
Perfect. I can't open up that door, Dave. I'm sorry.
So I want to go back to the documentary a bit.
Yes.
You hardly appear in the documentary.
No, I was almost upset that I did. I did talk to Toby a lot, and on the very first edit, I wasn't there at all. I said, going back to what I said at the start,
but you're listed as an executive producer.
Yes. So in fact, I'm listed as a producer as well. I think, because by the end, I was unwittingly producing it, as in, so the story of the documentary is that, as with many bands, we've been approached by lots of major broadcasters to make a documentary about King Crimson. And we've always said no, because we weren't really very interested in having the cookie cutter documentary that everybody automatically makes. So when they hear the band members sitting together in a studio reminiscing on the old time, cut to a live click, cut to some critics telling you how good the band were, you know, mix those three together and there's your movie. That's that movie that you see a lot. And Robert was a great fan of Toby Amey's first movie, and we met with him and said, you know, if you're interested, we will fund a movie, and our only instruction to you is to try and reinvent, small challenge here, try and reinvent the art form of music documentary. We find a new way of, you know, find a new way of looking at doing a music documentary that is not the documentary we've all seen before. And beyond that, we were very, very clear to entirely keep out of the artistic side of it, which, as my world is an art world, was very, very tough. But literally, Toby fortunately has said many times in interviews, we just said to him, no, your movie, you edit it, you make it. It became much more problematic, both in cost and access, to make than we'd originally envisaged. I think by the end, it cost four times, I think, what Toby originally thought it would cost to make. And so my role as I moved from being an executive producer to being one of a co-producer, because it needed a hand on the tiller to try and keep giving Toby what he needed in order to make this movie. But yes, in the first edit that he did, I wasn't there at all. Although he did constantly talk to me, I was mostly, I think, trying to give him pointers to what else he should be doing. So when he did an interview with me, I thought, yes, he doesn't need to do this interview, because I'm telling him, you know, if you go and talk to this guy, you'll probably get what you want. So I was very happy that I wasn't there. I said, because people don't need to know about the director and the producer. This is King Crimson, it's the band. But yes, in the end, the final version, I am there for about 2 seconds. But yes, it's, I think it's a wonderful movie. It's, as I said before, I think people have a very good sense of what's true. And that's it's a very true movie. As in,
it's a very political movie. Became obvious to me, knowing nothing about what this band is about, is the politics of the band. Yeah. And I was shocked that it was just so raw and so obvious from the beginning. And I think that's good. I think it's definitely truth. And I kind of appreciated the honesty, but I also understood the incredible stresses that each of the musicians were under. And when Fripp says, well, I don't think they'll tour again, the probability is pretty low that I can get them out on the road, I can see why. I understand why, because people are dying, literally dying, because they're giving it all they have.
No, I think if you aspire to be, in a sense, if you aspire to be the best band in the world, I don't mean that in other words, to put on the perfect concert for you. I don't mean that competing with other bands, but you know, if you aspire to be that good, then you are necessarily pretty much putting yourself through the mill. This is not going to be this is not going to be a pleasant thing to do. I think people sometimes enjoy King Crimson in retrospect, but I think while it's happening, it's not necessarily a very pleasant piece. It's not necessarily a fun place to be, because fun isn't the agenda. That's the point. Fun isn't the agenda. Toby himself has since realized that his experience of making the movie was probably quite like being in the band, as in it wasn't a totally pleasant place to be for him making the movie either.
And no, it wasn't.
But you end up with something incredibly real that I think does tell you about what it takes to bring wonderful art into the world. That's and because of poor Bill Rieflin, God bless him,
I know, he was wonderful. He was one of the most touching parts of the whole story, I thought.
Yes. So I'm very, very pleased with it. And
good. You should be. It's truthful. So at the beginning, Fripp says, being in this band has been really hard on me because I didn't have the band I really wanted until 2013. Help me understand what that's about.
So I think Robert has been in wonderful bands along the way. So I think the first King Crimson was one of the all-time great bands. Only lasted 9 months. What a legacy from 9 months. And then again, so there have been four. You had the 1969 band, which was a fantastic band. The one around Lark, Stones and Red again. The in 1981, Robert will happily tell you that he believed, for a while, that band. So early in 1981, when they were playing in New York, particularly, he thought they were probably the best band in the world live. So there have been bands along the way, and I think the final incarnation was unique in that it managed to bring together all of those brands. So until then, each time King Crimson reinvented itself, except for the odd piece, it left everything else behind. So you have the 1969 band, and then in 1973, I think the only piece they played from that period before was Schizoid Man. So except for that one,
they
piece,
should.
Except for that, it was an entirely new band, entirely new repertoire. Similarly, in 1981, they used to play Lux, Two, and Red. But other than that, it was an entirely new repertoire with new lineup. Whereas, uniquely, the final band had the members and the bandwidth to actually be able to touch. I think they played something from every single King Crimson album, except possibly Three of a Perfect Pair. Other than that, I think they played a piece from every single album, which hadn't been possible previously. So,
The whole thing with the three drums, the thing with the three drums put in there too, that created this enormous amount of like, what the hell are we doing here? Nobody does this. Who does this?
And my famous favorite comment of that was when it was very first announced and a reviewer had heard, King Crimson has three drummers. And the reviewer said, well, of course it has three drummers because we already knew what two drummers sounded like. and I love the three drummers. It's astonishing. There's a rock band, and how many bands if you read a review, and you could pretty much guarantee somewhere in the first three sentences of a review, they would mention the drummers. You think,
Bing.
Where does this happen in rock? Where does this happen in rock music? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and actually, they were great to watch. So, in fact, once you've got a show that is being presented as a classical show, with the musicians standing at the back, not necessarily leaping up and down, actually, the most interesting people just to watch are the drummers. They're fascinating.
I like their facial expressions. I mean, it's like
exactly. And they're busy. They're busy constantly doing things and finding things and tinkling things. Whereas actually, if they were at the back, you wouldn't have seen any of that. So, as a point of seeing, I can remember when Robert first said it. There's King Crimson. There's three drummers, and they're at the front.
Right.
Before they even did the first rehearsal, he said, "This is what I've seen. I've seen a new King Crimson. Seven people, three drummers, and they're at the front." And it was a wonderful band. So,
Well, we've taken lots of your time here. I know you've got a whole day ahead of you.
You've been so generous.
Right? I'm taking my wife out to dinner in 10 minutes. So this is perfect.
All right.
Perfect. Yes. Perfect. This is just like a therapy session for me. Thank you.
Yes.
50 minutes. Sorry, our time is over.
I hope I'll be seeing the two of you in... I don't know what the venue is, but it's the 25th.
It's the chapel in San Francisco.
I'm four blocks away from here in the Mission. You're going to love this neighborhood.
So if you've saved some torturously wonderful questions, come and throw them at us then. That'd be great fun. So.
Okay.
We will. Fear
Enjoy.
Not. We will. Thank you so much. Thank you. We so appreciate getting the royal package.
Yeah, there you are. So. More of it to come. Thanks very much.
Great. All right. Bye. Okay, so you've got the recording?
Yeah, I'm going to get the recording here. God damn, it better be there. Oh, hi, David. Sorry, we didn't record. No, I'm just kidding.
yeah, and you'll send me the link to it, will you?
I will. I will send it right over.
Lovely. That was fun. I'm so glad I stayed up all night. God.
Yeah.
Never been able to do that if I hadn't watched that documentary. Really?